Last night, today and tomorrow morning, we are investigating the stories in the Bible and how we might appreciate them more and understand them better. So for my sermon this morning, I've chosen a story from the book of 2 Samuel. And my scripture reading sets the scene for that story. 2 Samuel, chapter 18, beginning at verse 19, and reading through to verse 32. 2 Samuel, chapter 18, and beginning at verse 19. Then Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and carry tidings to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the power of his enemies." Joab said to him, "You are not to carry tidings today. You may carry tidings another day, but today you shall not do so, because the king's son is dead." Then Joab said to a Cushite, "Go, tell the king what you have seen." The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran. And then Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said again to Joab, "Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite." And Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, seeing that you have no reward for your tidings?" "Come what may," he said, "I will run." So he said to him, "Run." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates. The sentinel went up to the roof of the gate by the wall, and when he looked up, he saw a man running alone. The sentinel shouted and told the king. The king said, "If he is alone, then there are good tidings in his mouth." He kept coming and drew near. And then the sentinel saw another man running. And the sentinel called to the gatekeeper and said, "See, another man running alone." The king said, "He also is bringing good tidings." The sentinel said, "I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, son of Zadok." And the king said, "Oh, he is a good man, and he comes with good tidings." And then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, "All is well." He prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground and said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king." The king said, "Is it well with the young man, Absalom?" Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I do not know what it was." The king said, "Turn aside and stand here." So he turned aside and stood still. And then the Cushite came. And the Cushite said, "Good tidings for my lord the king, for the Lord has vindicated you this day, delivering you from the power of all who rose up against you." The king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" The Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to do you harm be like that young man." This is the word of the Lord. David is waiting. King David is waiting at the city gates of Mahanaim. And there he sits and waits, waiting for news of his son, Absalom. And why is David at the city gates of Mahanaim waiting for news of his son, Absalom? Well, it was like this. the story is tragic. The first time we meet Absalom is in the 13th chapter of the book of 2 Samuel. And the first thing we learn about Absalom is that he hates his brother Amnon. And we can hardly blame him, because Amnon has done a terrible thing. He has terribly abused his sister Tamar. The second thing we learn about Absalom is that he is a cunning so-and-so, because he never drops a hint that he hates his brother. Instead, he waits. And he waits. He waits for 2 full years to perfect his plot. And then, fools David, kills his brother, and runs off to the land of Geshur. And David? Well, David does nothing. He does nothing when Amnon attacks Tamar, does nothing to punish him. He does nothing to support his daughter, Tamar, and he completely ignores Absalom. So Absalom is left waiting. Waiting for David to do something, to do anything, either to pardon him and to welcome him back home, or to banish him from the land forever. But instead, David does nothing. So Absalom waits in exile. And there he waits, and he waits for David to do something. And the longer Absalom waits, the more he feels that he is the victim of injustice. So David's general, Joab, concocts a ruse to twist David's arm. And so he employs a wise woman from Tekoa to fool David. And this wise woman comes to David and says, "Your Majesty, I had 2 sons, but one of my sons killed the other. I now have only 1 son left, and it's a real mess. I don't know what to do. Can you please help me sort this all out?" Now, anybody can see that this is just a ruse to get David to face up to Absalom and to do something concerning Absalom. That is, everybody can see it except David. Finally, however, at long last, the penny drops, and David realizes this whole thing has been a charade to get him to do something about bringing Absalom home again. And so finally, that's what he does, but only because he's been fooled by this wise woman. But amazingly, when Absalom returns, David continues to ignore him, just keeps him waiting and waiting. If you look in 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 24, beginning of verse 24, 2 Samuel 14, 24, the king said, "Let him go to his own house. He is not to come into my presence." But David doesn't mention anything about punishing Absalom for what he's done. He mentions nothing about forgiving him on the other side. Instead, he just ignores him. And Absalom is left waiting and waiting for David to do something. Are you waiting? Are you waiting for somebody you know to do something, to say something, anything? Or are you just waiting? This is one of the frustrations I had when I was the head of the theology department at Newbold. I knew that at critical times of the year, I could always rely on certain people to keep me waiting. It might be, maybe from my colleagues, you know, it might be a contribution to a report that had to go off to the external examiners. It might be students' grades. There was always a good reason why I didn't get them when I needed them. There was always some emergency that had prevented it. There was never an emergency at any other time of year, just when I needed it. And I also got to know those students I could rely on to keep me waiting to receive their assignments. It was always their computer that crashed the day the assignment was due. It didn't crash in my lectures when they were surfing the internet, checking out their Facebook page or tweeting to their friends. It never crashed then, only the day when the assignment was due and I was left waiting. It was so annoying. Now, unless we're inclined to feel sorry for Absalom in this, it's probably true that none of us would want Absalom as our church pastor. 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 26. Well, actually, we'll start at verse 25. 2 Samuel 14, verse 25. Now in all Israel, there was no one to be praised so much for his beauty as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it, he weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. We looked at this slightly last night. Absalom is a handsome brute, and boy, does he know it. He is obsessed by the fact, and the pride of his life is his hair. He weighs it. I don't know how many of you have done that. He has weighed the hair of his head when he is shorn once a year like a prize sheep. 200 shekels worth of hair on his head. Not that long ago, it was my pleasure to go to the hairdresser. And I was served by Tracy. Tracy was a young apprentice, just starting work there. And obviously, the owner of the hairdressing business had told her it is a good idea to engage customers in polite conversation. It's good for business. So as I sat down in the chair in front of Tracy, and she looked down upon my crown and surveyed the task ahead of her, her first words to me were these. "You know, sir," she said, "it isn't really that you're bald, it's just that you're sort of thin all over." Well, thank you, Tracy. Now, let me assure you, Absalom is not thin all over. He has a luxuriant forest of dreadlocks on his head. Absalom would make Esau look thin all over. Now, Absalom is a self-centered individual with ruthless ambition and a head of unruly hair. Any similarities to prominent politician of your acquaintances? Entirely coincidental. Now, as I said, Absalom is a cunning fellow, and so he is patient, so he bides his time. So he waits and waits, waiting for the right time to strike. And in the meantime, he goes cruising around Jerusalem in a chariot with 50 outriders. He stands at the city gates of Jerusalem and meets disgruntled citizens and commiserates with them. He said, "Well, I hear what you say. I mean, I completely agree. You know, if I were in charge, maybe we could do something about it. You know, but as it is, you know, my hands are tied. I'm sorry." His ambition, as clear as glass. But David can't see it. And he still doesn't see it when Absalom makes up some cock and bull story about having to leave Jerusalem to go off and make a vow to the Lord. And David lets him go. We read that in chapter 15 and verse 9. 2 Samuel 15:9. It's just simple words. The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he got up and he went to Hebron. Now, as most of you know, the Hebrew word for peace is shalom. And we talk about Absalom. But in Hebrew, his name is Av-Shalom. His name means Father of Peace. Remember the play on words we were looking at last night? So David says to Av-Shalom, King of Peace, "Go in peace." But peace is the last thing on Absalom's mind. And Absalom acts immediately. He declares himself king. He attracts to himself celebrity defectors, such as Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's chief counselor. And support for Absalom grows, and David has to flee for his life, getting out of Jerusalem just in the nick of time as Absalom arrives with his troops. But this is the issue. How is Absalom going to finish off the old man? How is he going to get rid of David? Well, he receives advice from two individuals. On the one hand, he gets advice from the profound wise man and astute tactician, Ahithophel, the Gilonite. But on the other hand, he receives advice from Hushai, the Archite, David's undercover agent in Absalom's court. So, the traitor, Ahithophel the Gilonite, gives David shrewd advice. He says, "Your Majesty, you realize that King David is a beaten man, his troops are demoralized. Don't give him time to lick his wounds. No, don't waste time. Strike, strike now. Send me out with the army. I will target David. I will kill David. I'll bring his head back to you, and the kingdom will be yours." Now, this is sound military and political advice. And all of Absalom's advisors agree. But Hushai the Archite, David's undercover agent, remember, knows his man. And so he appeals instead to Absalom's vanity. He says, "Your Majesty, your father David has a fearsome reputation as a warrior. You cannot allow just anybody to go out against a soldier like that. No, no, this requires that we spend time. Let us wait. Let us wait. Let us call together the greatest soldiers in the army. And these soldiers then need to be led by a charismatic leader of exceptional ability, in my opinion. No, no, let us wait. Let us call the army together and let them be led by you.
And you will then lead them in a devastating campaign of shock and awe that will demonstrate to the entire nation your majesty, your greatness, and your power. And Absalom reflected on that for a split second and said, I see what you mean. Let's do it. And so with that delay, David has time to escape to the city of Mahanaim beyond the Jordan. There he prepares his troops. He stations himself by the gates of Mahanaim as the troops go out to face Absalom. And the story then gives hardly any space at all to the battle. It concentrates largely on Absalom and his hair. If you've ever heard of a military report centering on somebody's hair, well, we have it here. We've already seen how obsessed Absalom is with his hair. It sums up his vanity. And now he hangs in a tree with 200 shekels worth of hair entwined in its branches. And then, disobeying David, Joab kills Absalom and buries him without ceremony. But David doesn't know. David hasn't heard. So David is waiting. King David is waiting at the city gates of Mahanaim. And there he sits and he waits, waiting for news of his son Absalom. This isn't the first time that David has been waiting for news of somebody from the battlefield. The first time he was waiting to hear for news from the battlefield, he was waiting to hear news concerning Uriah the Hittite, the husband of Bathsheba, who happens to be pregnant by David. And David wants Uriah dead. David gives Joab instructions on how to kill him on the battlefield. And then David waits and waits for news of Uriah. And then in that story, the story delays and delays and delays David getting the news. David is waiting and waiting for verse after verse. What's happened to Uriah? Is he dead yet? Just here in this story, David is waiting again, this time at the city gates of Mahanaim, and this time waiting for news of Absalom. On the battlefield, they argue with one another. Are they going to send news to David that Absalom is dead, or are they not? Yes, they will. No, they won't. Yes, they will. No, they won't. Okay, then, why don't you go? They're arguing about it. Two messengers, as we read, set off in different directions. A watchman on the wall of Mahanaim sees a runner coming towards the city gates. And then a second runner coming from a separate direction, running to the city gates. Most of this story is taken up with getting the news to David, while David waits and waits and waits. Two battles, two deaths, and in both of them, David is waiting. In the first, waiting for news of Uriah. In the second, waiting for news of Absalom. And in both those stories, the news is delayed and delayed. And the Bible does that quite deliberately, because it is preparing us for David's response once he gets the news. When David receives the news concerning Uriah, His response is quite callous. If you look back to 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 25. So the messenger tells him, Uriah is dead. And David says there in verse 25, do not let this matter trouble you. For the sword devours now one and now another. Press your attack on the city and overthrow it. Do not let this matter trouble you. These things happen. What do you expect? It's warfare. But when David receives news of Absalom's death, how does he respond to that? We find that in 2 Samuel 18, beginning in verse 33. It follows on from the scripture reading that we had. 2 Samuel 18, verse 33. The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I had died instead of you. O Absalom, my son. It was told Joab, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the troops. For the troops heard that day the king is grieving for his son. The troops stole into the city that day as soldiers steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, O my son, Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. So it came to pass that when David heard that Absalom was slain, he wept and wept and wept because he realized it was now too late. That is why we're told he was very moved. The king was moved. That word is used elsewhere in 2 Samuel to describe an earthquake. That's the emotion. Now, this isn't the first time when David has wept when he's received news from the battlefield. Right at the beginning of 2 Samuel, he receives news from the battle that King Saul and his son Jonathan have been killed. And when he receives that news, David composes and sings a wonderful poem with the famous refrain, Oh, how the mighty are fallen. How the mighty are fallen. But here, with the death of Absalom, there is no poetry, just a heart-wrenching wailing. Oh, Absalom, my son, Absalom. David, when he heard the news that Uriah was dead, said, Do not let this matter trouble you. But when he hears that Absalom is dead, he is mightily troubled. And David isn't simply weeping for Absalom. He's also weeping for himself. He's weeping for all of those lost opportunities, the failure to be the person that he should have been, and the realization that it's now too late. It's too late now to be the father he should have been. And the key to that, I think, is what David calls Absalom. If you come with me to the beginning of 2 Samuel 18, in verse 5, there in verse 5, he's sending his troops off to meet Absalom, and he gave them orders. And the order is, deal gently for my sake with the young man, Absalom. The young man. His language is formal, distant. The young man. You come to verse 12, and one of the soldiers quotes what David said in verse 12. Repetition here. He said, I heard him say, look right at the end of verse 12, for my sake, protect the young man, Absalom. Then in verse 29, when that first messenger arrives, the king asks the question. Verse 29, the king said, is it well with the young man, Absalom? Then the second messenger arrives, and he repeats it again. Verse 32, the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man, Absalom? But now he is told that Absalom is dead. Absalom is no longer the young man. He is now my son. My son. My son, Absalom. He speaks personally, emotionally. Throughout this whole story of David and Absalom, all six chapters of it, David on only one occasion calls Absalom my son. Other than that, Absalom is always the young man, or once he's rebelled, he calls him the king, but never my son until Absalom dies. And then he can't stop. 1833. Oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom. Would that I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son. And 19, verse 4. The king covered his face and the king cried with a loud voice. Oh, my son, Absalom. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. He can't stop because now he realizes it's too late. When David heard that Absalom was slain, we're invited into his own private tragedy. The tragedy of a man who waited and who waited too long to do the right thing. So when David heard that Absalom was slain, he realized he'd waited too long. So he wept and wept because there was nothing else he could do. Few people, in my experience anyway, few people preach on these chapters. And the reason for that, I think, is God. Where is God in all of these episodes in 2 Samuel? If you look at 2 Samuel from chapter 9 through to chapter 20, there's a huge block there with David and his family. God only does something explicitly. Three times in 12 chapters does it say that God does anything. And then it's just briefly, just three fleeting references to God doing something. But most of these chapters seem to be stuffed full of human beings stumbling from one mess to the next, all of their frailties on public display, all of their ambitions and their vanities, they're crystal clear. Their lust and their incompetence and the capacity to do anything except the right thing. But that, of course, is the point. That is the point of these stories. Because in the lives of David and Absalom, we see our own lives writ large. And not just our individual lives either, but the life of the corporate church as well. How many tragedies in the history of the Adventist church could have been avoided if occasionally we had said, as a body, corporately, look, we're sorry. We didn't do what we should have done. We're going to do everything we can to put it right. Would you please forgive us? And how many tragedies in our personal lives could have been avoided? I mean, in our families, in our marriages, in our careers, if we had been willing to admit that we were wrong, and that now, right now, not tomorrow, not next week, not waiting for somebody else to make the first move, but now, right now, is the time to put it right, rather than waiting and waiting until it's too late to do anything about it. For if that is what we do, either as individuals or as the church collectively, then we are doomed to experience the tragedy that was David's. For you will recall that when David heard that Absalom was slain, he wept and wept and wept.